trying to figure out the truth about anything that's being claimed is like damn near impossible. There's just this flood of information, a lot of bad information, a lot of good information, a lot of contradictory information. And literally you could get sucked in to endlessly searching, or you latch onto something just because you're so tired of searching. You just want to find something that you can say, this is what's true. I don't want to keep being agnostic. It's exhausting.
You want to do sense making.
Exactly. And so you just pick something that validates your experience or whatever, and you just latch onto it and become an evangelist for it. And I'm like, I don't want any of that. So I'm not even going to try to figure out what's true. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a relentless pursuit of what's not true. And I'm going to try to figure out all the things that I can say, okay, this is bullshit. I can prove that it's bullshit. And then I can eliminate that and say, I know that this isn't true. I don't know what is true, but I know that that isn't true. And you know what's amazing? Once you start doing that,
it's a lot.
The list of things that are like easily discernible as bullshit, when you start looking for bullshit, yeah. If you go on a bullshit hunt exclusively, it's incredible. And the number of things that are remaining in the this might be true bucket is actually kind of small,
right?
You know?
Yeah, I think that was like a misinterpretation of what would happen and maybe a rose-colored glasses prediction about the future that I made 10 years ago. It was like, with this technology, all the truth will come out. Well, maybe yeah. That was true, but it was 100x'd by bullshit at least. I actually think, and you said something similar to this, it's an exciting problem to have. I got nothing, I say it's all mine. I'm falling, I panic one time. Begging for the day, demand to get shine. No sleep, success, I'm stressing all night. Can't live off no one, my meal's all mine. Don't want no scraps, damn, they hand me down. On a drive, I'm looking for a lane, so I'm gonna hit the wall if it means I'll fly. Working hard, gonna lose my mind, yeah, yeah, mind, yeah, yeah. Take a chance, ain't gonna mess around, yeah, yeah, round, yeah. Time to double down, invent it all, cause you got nothing to lose. Hi, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. If I sound a little bit out of breath, it's because I just spent probably the last 30 minutes dancing to this song that you're listening to in the background. This guy, his name is Dayjack, D-A-Y-E Jack. Go find him and follow him on Spotify or whatever you do with artists that you like. I've been using a lot of his stuff lately, and here's how I've been trying to spread the word about Day. It's like he captures the spirit of old school rap, but if you go back and you listen to a lot of old school rap, I'm sorry. I am so sorry. It is just not that good. You go back and you listen to stuff from the 80s or the early 90s, the beats are just kind of like simple. Even the classics, and yeah, I'm going to say it, It Takes Two, When They Reminisce Over You, the songs with the cool samples of great older music. You go back and you listen to like the biggest hits of the 80s or the 90s, and you're like, whoa, somebody needs to call Dr. Dre. And then you say, wait a minute, Dr. Dre worked on this. He just did it without the blessings of modern technology. And we've been spoiled. You know, even though rap is ruined by people just mumbling, it's hard to go back and have that authentic experience with the older stuff. So this guy, long story short, this guy seems to capture the spirit of the older stuff, but beautifully blended with modern technology to, I don't know, I think this guy is truly unique, so I hope you check him out. I never talk about the music that you're hearing on this show. You're just supposed to infer why it's here, what it means, but I also don't spend 30 minutes dancing to everything before I put it in the show, so maybe that's why you're getting this speech. How exciting to welcome Isaac Morehouse back to the show, one of my favorite guests, one of my favorite people to talk to. If we both had the time, I would say to Isaac Morehouse, hey, let's do our own podcast together. But today's conversation is an extension of previous conversations that Isaac and I have had over the last year or so. He was on mid-2020. I'm going to link this in the show notes. We had a conversation called All News is Fake News. But in a previous episode, we also talked about a kind of professional philosophy that Isaac has promoted. He wrote a book about it. It's called Don't Do Stuff You Hate. That sounds obvious, right? But there's more to it than you think, and we're going to talk about that to get a running start in our conversation today. If you're new and you're unfamiliar with Isaac, he's the founder of Praxis, this professional development college alternative that we promote indirectly in just about every episode of the podcast. Isaac is also the founder of Crash. That's crash.co, linked in the show notes as well. It's a career launch platform for those who have discovered the shortcomings, the inconveniences of the permission mentality. So, yeah, like I said, today is February 21st. Check back later in the week. I've got Emotional Manipulators for Hire, Episode 6, coming out with Nathan Frazier on the power of story. You know what? I'm going to talk to Isaac about that, too. So you're about to join our conversation already in progress. I had started the recording, but I didn't know I had already started the show. But all of a sudden, we were like, wow, this is already the show. You know how that happens sometimes? All right, here's my conversation with my friend Isaac Morehouse on how to use an addition by subtraction approach to not only finding the perfect career, but also for improving your information diet. All right, what a day. Thank you for listening and take care. You got to lose it, take a gamble, do it, don't need to settle in, get 'em down. You got to lose it, take a gamble, do it, don't need to settle in, get 'em down tonight. Man, I gotta tell you, I already recorded for like 2 hours today. I am feeling pretty enthusiastic right now because I do this show with a friend of mine. Let's just start with this. I'm recording. Are you ready?
Oh, of course. I just assume it's all being recorded by the NSA or somebody.
I didn't get the part where you called me my man in there. So, oh well. I just told people about it. Thank you, by the way. My favorite thing to be called. And it's like 1 p.m. Eastern right now. Today, I already recorded for 2 hours with my friend Nathan Frazier. Has he ever come across your radar? He's a copywriter.
I don't think so.
Oh, if you're still on Facebook, follow this guy. He is so good on Facebook. But I got off Facebook. I want to talk to you about that.
I did as well. So.
Oh, great. Well, I'll send you screenshots of Nathan Frazier then somewhere else. So he and I do this show called Emotional Manipulators for Hire, where we kind of compare marketing to media manipulation. Like we compare the tactics of marketing to propaganda. We just did an hour and a half on stories. Right? The sort of story brand idea, but also how stories are used to basically manage people's perceptions and how they've been used that way historically. And I also put out an older episode of us today talking about tribalism and true believers. Have you ever read Eric Hofer's book, or are you familiar with it? It's called The True Believer.
I'm familiar with it. I haven't read it though.
Okay. You don't even have to have read it. I think it's going to come up in our conversation today because I listened to a recent episode of your podcast called Stop Seeking the Truth. And I think this is a nice place to pick up from the last two conversations that we've had. So the first thing I wanted to do, though, was just talk about what's happening with Crash right now. I know it's probably been about 6 months since you've been on the show, so I just wanted to hear what the updates were.
Yeah, so cranking away. I mean, the nitty gritty, like I'm so close to it. I'm like, oh, well, we shipped all these product upgrades, and then we changed the way that we do this. But from a big picture perspective, we're doing the same thing that we've been doing, which is helping people win jobs faster by demonstrating their value through video and projects instead of sending resumes and relying on, you know, basically a lottery. I'll blast a resume out 100 times and hope that mine gets noticed. Being in the phase, you know, sort of that, I would say like the first couple years of a new company, especially a new consumer company, you're really in the learning phase more than anything. You're trying to understand how your users interact with the product. And you're really trying to look at the users that are having the most success and understand how and why, and then trying to understand how to help the rest of the users do that. And so by kind of really following all the, you know, there's all these things that you would never expect when you design a product that, you know, people like can't use it because they, you know, accidentally click on the wrong thing or whatever. So from really small stuff to really big stuff. So we've kind of just been dialing in the product around that and really, really focusing on people who have been successful using Crash, which honestly is anyone who has completed a pitch and sent it.
Yeah.
That's it. Once you do that, it's like it clicks, you see it, you feel it, you get a response to that pitch. You may not get an interview from your first pitch, but people are getting an interview for every 3 pitches on average and an offer for every 9 on average. And so it's like once you've done it once, those users are off to the races. They love it. It's better than but getting somebody to do that once is surprisingly hard because you're in that mindset.
It's you already have a resume. Shift.
Yeah, you already have a resume. You go to the jobs board, apply. There's always one click apply, attach resume, apply. And you're like, well, I did that like 20 times today. I feel like I'm putting in work on the job hunt. I did. Okay, the rest is up to fate. It's up to the economy, right? Whereas you get on Crash and it's like, okay, pick a company you're really excited about. Research them for a little bit. Make them a little project. Make them a little video. whoa, hold on, that takes some work. So there's that hesitancy at first. And we see this interesting pattern where people will look at it and be like, this is cool. This makes sense. I can see how a video pitch is going to get more response. Let me go poke around. I'm not really ready to record a video. I'll look at this later. And then they go about spending another 2 months sending resumes. And then they come back to Crash. And they're like, okay, I was interested at first, but I thought, well, I already almost have a second interview with this one job and this other job emailed me back. So I think I probably pretty much have a job. I'll just keep sending resumes. 2 more months of that, nothing. And they come back and they're like, all right, now I got to change it up, right? So there's kind of this weird, where, you know, the trick with any consumer product, and maybe this will tap into some of the stuff you've been talking about with marketing and what's the line between marketing manipulation, whatever. The trick with a consumer product is, can you get a customer a better outcome without requiring them to be a better person? In fact, The best products let people indulge their weak points and actually make them feel better about the things that they're not doing very well in life in some way. That kind of, yeah, you know what? Like, what do we all love? We all love instant gratification. We all love ourselves, whatever, right? And so if your product feeds that, it's going to be an easier product to get people to use. Now, if it starts to destroy their lives in the long run, then they'll stop using it eventually. But you've got to be able to deliver them some value too. But asking, so the big challenge with Crash, and we knew this going in, we're essentially asking you to level up a little bit and to be the best version of yourself. And my goal has always been, can we structure a product in such a way that you never feel like you're being asked to be better. You're just doing something that's enjoyable. And the end result is you become better, right? Like by accident, you develop better habits. But the process of using Crash on your job hunt changes your mind frame and you think of yourself as in more control. You get more creative, right? That's my goal. But it's very hard to say somebody, do what you already want to do, which is the least amount of work possible.
Yeah, I was thinking
right?
That.
And so like, It's tough. It's tough. So trying to scale that essentially.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask if you guys have a way of like nudging the person. There are like novel operations that this requires, putting yourself on video. I remember like reviewing the profile of a friend of mine who's on Crash and looking at the video. And even just like watching what they had made, being like, geez, could I do this? Like, I'm a professional podcaster for 9 or 10 years at this point. Could I make a video pitching myself like this? It was confronting. So I don't know if like that's such a common balking point for people that you and your team have basically developed an intervention at that point. Like, look, you're going to be back in a few months. You're going to get tired of doing things the same old, same old. So let's just like confront this obstacle and do this. Now, I don't know if there's a way to counsel somebody through that or if you guys even try.
It is hard because you're making a promise that's like, look, if you put in a little work ahead of time, it's going to be less work overall. You're going to get much better outcomes and you're going to be happier. And that's totally true. But that's the same thing that's true of working out or getting up a little early and making whatever, right? Those things are true. And like, if someone actually does them, they're never going to come back to you later and say, I'm so mad that you convinced me to try that. My life is now worse, right? Like that doesn't happen. It's like when I challenge people to blog every day for 30 days, I've never once had someone come back and said, I actually did it for 30 days and I'm mad that I did. My life is worse, right? Doesn't happen, but it's still, you're promising something that you can't guarantee, right? I can't guarantee you're going to get a specific job if you make a specific video right now, 100%. And so it's like, well, all you're doing is telling me to put in more work on the front end. Yeah. And then you're just telling me that like vague good things will happen on the back end. And they will. And I can give you some stats to back it up. Like our job seekers takes an average of 150 resumes to get an interview. And it takes an average of 3 pitches to get an interview. Right. I can tell you some stats in the aggregate, but still where we are right now is kind of understanding it. And you're right. The video is the sticking point and the video is also the most valuable part about the pitch. And so people will kind of build a pitch and then they'll be like, I don't want to record that video. They'll overthink it or whatever. So what we're kind of playing around with right now is because we've experimented with this, we'll get on and we'll just with an individual user say, hey, let me jump on a Zoom call with you. I want to onboard you personally to the product. And we've done this hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. And then I'll ask them 3 questions. I'll be like, well, tell me about a company that's interesting to you. And they'll give me a company. And then I'll say, okay, what excites you about that company? What do you love about them? They'll answer that in a great way, just in casual conversation. Then I'll say, what's your story? What makes you wake up in the morning? And they'll answer that in a great way. And then I'll say, how do you think who you are and what that company does connect? Like, why would you be a good fit there? And they'll answer it in a phenomenal way. And then I'll say, stop right there. Those three questions you just answered, that's your pitch video. That's it. And just how you did with me, like a conversation. And so having that epiphany that like every single person, they can give me answers to those questions in a conversation that are incredibly compelling that a hiring manager would be very attracted to. But when you ask them, make a video, it's very hard. So we're kind of looking at ways within the product to basically do that, to say, okay, hit record and just, you know, what is it you love about this company, whatever. And like, take the pressure off. This is not your official pitch video, whatever. Okay, now answer this question, this one. And then we'll stitch them together automatically and let you see, watch that video and say, hey, do you want to use this as your pitch or something along those lines? We're trying to experiment with a way to lower that barrier and make it not feel like it's such a high stakes thing to just record a video.
Right. And it sounds like the ideal that you were describing for like not asking, I don't want to say not asking too much of people. That's not the right way, but it's the idea. It reminds me of something that we've talked about before on the show, which is your addition by subtraction, I guess we could call it, approach to finding the right career. That people kind of spin their wheels maybe for most of their lives in some cases, or for far too long, trying to discover some kind of passion instead of, I mean, isn't that the title of your book, Don't Do Stuff You Hate? Is that what, that's what it's called?
Yeah.
So instead of this process of elimination, of getting rid of identifying, like being really honest with yourself, auditing the things that you hate to do and getting them out of your life. So it sounds like it's a little bit of that in the crash philosophy too.
Very much so. Very much so. Because it's like, it's overwhelming to say, do this really big, good thing or pick the one career, whatever it is. Hey, how about just don't do a bunch of useless stuff, right? Don't. That's why we lead with burn your resume.
Yeah.
Well, what's the point of that? What we're saying is the resume is useless and nobody likes it. Nobody likes making them. Nobody likes sending them out. Just stop doing that. Burn it. Now, what are you left with? Okay, well, what am I going to send if I want to apply for a job? Great. Let's just put something together that's not a resume. Let's just start there. It can be really simple and you're already making an improvement. So we are trying to do that, trying to figure out, make the barrier to sending a great pitch as low as possible. But of course, if you go too low, if you turn it into sort of the mass jobs board, hey, just press one button and we'll automatically send a pitch on your behalf. Well, then it loses all of its value because there's nothing about it that's, you know, unique and whatever. So trying to meet that spot of like, make it as easy as possible while still helping people to showcase something real, something genuine, something that can't be faked or fabricated or copied and pasted.
Yeah. All right. So I'm excited to preview this and let the audience know that we're also going to be talking about addition by subtraction in terms of your information diet very, very soon. But as a transition to that, I want to talk a little bit about why you decided to leave. I mean, I don't know if I want to say you left all of social media, but you left Facebook. And how did you make that decision?
Yeah. So I'm definitely very active on Twitter still in a sort of narrow and focused way. So Facebook, it's interesting. I got to start by saying Facebook, Praxis never would have got off the ground without Facebook.
Sure, right.
It was incredibly valuable. And even before then, years before, right when Facebook started, like 2007, 2008, 2009 for sure, I was on there for a program I ran called Students for a Free Economy. It was sort of free market libertarian student organization in the state of Michigan. I would go all around to college campuses. And Facebook was incredible then. I mean, I'm talking like, it was like candy from a baby stuff. When they first came out with ads, I would put $5 on an ad and I would target it to students at Central Michigan University and an ad saying, we're bringing John Stossel to campus. And the ad would take them to the event on Facebook. That ad would get like 200 people to RSVP to the Facebook event. And back in those days, you could expect about 75% of Facebook RSVPs to show up in person.
Right.
I could put $5 and I could get like 100+ people to show up at an event. It was incredible. Anyway, so I kind of, you know, built my own brand by just sharing stuff on Facebook all the time. You know, I was blogging and I would share stuff and I would get in conversations and it was great. And Praxis, you know, benefited from that. The beginning of the decline for me was when they made the stark separation. This was a long time ago, but between pages and profiles. So like Praxis had to have a page and rather than like a group or a profile, whatever. And then when they made it so that pages, nothing that a page post would show up in anybody's newsfeed unless you paid for it.
Yeah.
Now that might've been a great business move for them, but it was definitely brutal for organic reach for all the stuff that we were doing. So then it became this constant game of like, well, now I have to share stuff on my personal account that I want people to see related to Praxis. And then they made it so that if you share external links, they don't get as much exposure as if you just write something internally.
Right.
And I'm like, well, a lot of stuff is links to articles and whatever. And little by little, I found myself, when I was on Facebook, I felt like I was always trying to figure out how to not get screwed by whatever changes they've made to their algorithm.
Yes.
And I'm like, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be a robot that's like those articles you read that aren't even English because they're just written for SEO and nothing else, you know?
It's like the whole thing, right? It's like the career thing. It's like a bunch of people in a boardroom who go, you know what people are really comfortable with? The permission mentality. You know what people love to do? Stand in line and wait to be told what to do. So let's use that as part of our model. Now, I felt the same way. And we were actually, this conversation that I had before this, you know, we were talking just about the evolution or devolution of the last 20 years with this technology and the doors that we thought it would open, the doors that it did open, right? And it's really the last 5 years that things have started to change and some rethinking has been required. But yeah, we brought 10,000 people into a Facebook page, then realized we couldn't really do anything with it and it wasn't worth paying because we didn't have a high ticket offer that would have justified, you know, paying to get people to see our posts. So we tried to build community there in a group where people could have discussions and, you know, I could share updates. But, you know, even still, it's like a bunch of people collecting around. I like, at the very least, the name of this group. School Sucks, or I like joining groups, or I like the podcast, and it wasn't focused. I know some people are able to use Facebook effectively to build relationships and marketing, but I think the leverage of it had just sort of run out for me. It wasn't a good place to be, wasn't making me feel any better. I understand all of the behaviorism and how I am, even though I understand it, still somehow susceptible to it at times. So in this kind of symbolic way, I got off because I wanted to create, you know, a private community for like really focused, like action oriented, capped at 200 people and just move them on to first Discord. And then we're going to have to get off Discord too and go to probably Gilded. But that's underway. It's been great. We have meetings every week. People are setting up their own groups and clubs in there. And it's very manageable. And if there's something that is a problem, it can be addressed. So I think that's at least the way of the future is to have a focus group that could actually like support each other and build something. And that just got really difficult to do on Facebook.
Yeah, it's so interesting. When it was just a simpler platform and, you know, your feed just showed in chronological order, whatever you subscribe to and whatever, people started doing a lot of interesting things with it. And you see this with a lot of software. Then the company realizes, hey, people are doing all these things. Let's build specific functionality for those things, right? You often make the experience worse in some ways. Mm-hmm. When things are kind of happening organically, even if they're not very efficient, it can be better because these sort of community norms can emerge. The way people use your product may be different than you expected. It's funny for me, it was like a two-phase process of getting off Facebook. Phase one was, I stopped enjoying it personally, and I used to love it personally. Mm-hmm. And I realized like the conversation quality seemed to get lower and lower. At least what I was seeing in my feed, a lot of vitriol, a lot of stuff that just wasn't really offering me a lot of value as a consumer of information. But when I posted stuff, it still got a lot of traction. So I was like, all right, well, it's not that personally enjoyable, but it's beneficial for building the company basically, and getting a message out there and building the brand and whatnot. And so then it turned into something where I was basically just posting as a creator, but not as a consumer. I wasn't going on there engaging anything. Mm-hmm. And then it got to the point where that lost all of its value. I mean, I remember I used to be able to, like, on my personal blog, for example, if I would link a post, just post it onto Facebook, that day I would probably get 200 clicks on that. That came from Facebook.
Yep.
Now, if I post a link from my blog to Facebook, the same number of people. I think I'm capped out at whatever they cap you at, 5,000, which I mean, like maybe 2-3, like their algorithm really, really dings linking to external content now. And so like, even as a distribution mechanism, it became really, really crappy. And I just realized like over time, I was never there anymore. I would have things that would automatically post to Facebook, like when I updated my blog or something. And the few times I went there and posted something, I had an inbox full of direct messages that were like weird people I'd never met.
Weird
and
they
were
people, like, yeah. Just
spammy, strange messages, kind of like LinkedIn. Like I can't go on LinkedIn anymore because my inbox is like 100+ weird people trying to sell me insurance or some shit. And I was like, okay, every time I went there, it just made me grumpy. So I just stopped. And that was like Like I stopped almost entirely about a year and a half ago. And then about 6 months ago, I finally just deleted the app from my phone and I downloaded all my debt. The one thing, I had a lot of pictures and private albums that I was just using it as a place to store pictures, like family photos and stuff. So I got all my data off. I deleted the app from my phone and I haven't been on since. Now, I didn't delete my account because I'm like, I don't care. I like all the stuff that's there. If somebody finds my account and finds my website or something from that, that's fine. I know, no need to delete that as a luck surface, mm-hmm. but I'm done. I'm not on this platform. I'm not going to engage in it. And I did the same thing with LinkedIn, even though LinkedIn had some business value in terms of like every once in a while, there's a message that's valuable. It just got overwhelmingly full of spam. And now it's just Twitter for me in a pretty narrow way. I've never used Instagram or TikTok or Snapchat. I don't get them. They don't do anything for me.
Yeah. I mean, if you like silly little videos, if you like to make silly little videos, which is like my bread and butter, then Instagram is great. It works much better than Facebook for that. So yeah, I deactivated my Facebook account. I didn't even download all the data. I just, you know, deactivated it, deleted it from everywhere. And you can still use Messenger that way, which is how I communicate with a whole bunch of people. And I archive the group, which basically just means it freezes it as it is, and people who are in it can still find it. It's also set to private. So no new person could discover the group. Nobody can post, join, like, comment. It's just like frozen in time, February 1st, 2021. And I think I did it that way just because I set that date, like, get off here by this date. So I didn't scramble through, you know, how do I get everything off and can I capture the good stuff that's in this group? Can I organize it in any way? It's just like, I'll organize something else on a smaller scale, I think for more reward. So, okay, let's say you get into an elevator of a fairly tall building with a man who is on his phone and he says what you said, right? There's too much vitriol here. The quality of the conversation is terrible. How do you explain the decline of that social aspect of Facebook as you ride the elevator with this man?
Yeah, that's a challenge because I myself don't know for sure. Mm. I've wondered that myself. Like, why? I understand the signal to noise ratio getting worse as more people join and it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And yes, part of the decline in quality of my newsfeed was now a bunch of, you know, weird old people are getting on and posting like inspirational cat poster, fluffy type stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's part of it. But it was like my own newsfeed. I was following the same people that I had been before, but like the quality of the average post, it just went down. And I noticed the only trends that I could really point to was a lot of the people that were the most interesting started doing more on Twitter and less on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is exactly. I did the same thing and I can't put it into words why. I mean, I don't know how else to put it, but it's like Twitter has all kinds of crappy, you know, stuff that you can find as well. But on average, it's like a higher level of intelligence conversation that's happening mm-hmm. there than on Facebook. I don't know why that is. I couldn't tell you. It's very strange, but it happened, and it happened so much so that it was like, there were a few pockets of interesting on Facebook, where people were still having, but they felt like they were just retread conversations over and over again. There wasn't like new stuff flowing in, new interesting ideas to me. I wasn't expanding my mind in any way anymore, like I had been at first. I really couldn't tell you what caused that to happen. I'd be curious to hear your theory.
I don't know if you've ever looked at the differences between Facebook and Twitter and as far as how the algorithm works for promoting or discouraging certain types of interaction. My understanding mm-hmm. was that Facebook, as it has worked so far or in recent years, creates more of an echo chamber effect, where Twitter seems to encourage more types of discourse. Like you're encountering much more conflicting points of view in a greater volume on Twitter. And I think that probably is determined to some degree how you're using it. But, you know, Facebook is sort of watching your behavior. I mean, if you go back and you look at the Cambridge Analytica stuff, and I, in a recent show, posted Alexander Nix, who I think was the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, and the way he talks about the marketing capabilities of Facebook, that we're able to collect 4,000 psychographic data points on the average adult, you can really, really tailor what somebody is seeing there. And that might be a technology that Twitter simply doesn't have. So obviously, if people become more echo chambered and more close-minded, over a period of, let's say, a decade, the quality of the conversation is going to deteriorate because anybody who doesn't agree with you is just an asshole. right? Or a person who escaped a mental institution. I mean, people really, you know, on both sides tell themselves stories like that. And you also get this this real good and evil dichotomy that people seem to enjoy. And Facebook seems to promote that. And it's also interesting that if you disengage from Facebook, it will start to show you things to upset you. It's that sophisticated. Like, I'm like, why am I seeing posts of this guy who every time I see something from him, it just irritates me? And I go, oh, because I'm disengaging. Because I'm disengaged. And then Facebook will start telling you, like, FOMO things. Like, do you know that this friend of yours and this friend of yours do this thing? Or it'll say, like, so-and-so commented on so-and-so's post, trying to get you to, like, hey, you're interested in these people. Why don't you think about re-engaging? This is where all the fun is. This is where all the action is.
So it's possible the infrastructure itself, the architecture, in maximizing for engagement, it leads to the things that get the most engagement, or just the fact of, like, having max engagement, like where you just, instead of one comment in a thread, right? We'll put it this way. If you have a thread where somebody's commented, if that person has posted one comment, the odds that it's decent quality are about 10 times higher than if one person has posted like 8 comments, right? How many times have you seen somebody who they just have to reply to every reply and they're on there so many times? That's usually a crappy conversation, right? But that's high engagement. So like the thing that gets the max engagement maybe is not always the, you know, maybe it leads to quality decline. That's interesting. And I know Twitter has gotten a little bit worse. I'll put it this way. It's more work now. It takes more work than it used to keep your feed quality and to sort of cultivate it. But the thing that I notice on Twitter that I didn't notice as much on Facebook, one, Facebook is a lot less funny. There's a lot less parody and sarcasm and whatever.
Right.
A lot more self-seriousness and like either choir preaching or arguing, not as much playfulness in some ways. And there's not... my feed tended to homogenize around like a really broad. So like I would go on Tucker Carlson, for example, and then I get all these conservatives following me and whatever else. And then like, you could see, you know, the skew of whatever, who's following me and whatever would sort of, but it's kind of this broad, like libertarian, conservative, homeschooled sort of roughly in that milieu. And it was kind of like, all basically like that. Whereas on Twitter, I occupy several different worlds. So I have, there's the NBA corner of Twitter and I follow a bunch of accounts that are tweeting about NBA games. And then there's parody NBA Twitter, which is hilarious, right? A bunch of like fake accounts that are pretend to be players and do all this, you know, shit posting. Then there's crypto Twitter and parody crypto Twitter, right? And then there's like startup Twitter where all the VCs and startup founders and like they're all there, you know. Then there's kind of libertarian Twitter or economics nerd Twitter. I've got these different universes in Twitter that I get to see tidbits of from different areas of interest that I have. And I feel they have a real distinction. They don't blend together. And the people that I follow in those don't follow each other. Like when I tweet about the NBA, almost none of my followers engage it because NBA Twitter is where I'm mostly a consumer and not really a producer. My own Twitter followers are mostly around my company and education type stuff, the type of stuff we would talk about. And so you kind of get these like, it's like being a whole person, right? I've got a lot of interests and a lot of different things. Whereas I felt Facebook started to just turn into one giant glob of just like, you knew what was going to happen when you went to your Facebook feed. It would just show you the kind of things your Facebook feed thinks, right? As like one big thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There it became like surprises were like fewer and further between.
Yes.
I absolutely had the same experience. I even had the experience with the School Sucks group. So while we're kind of talking about this technology that most people use for their information diet, I wanted to ask you and share this with my audience about a podcast you did fairly recently called Stop Seeking the Truth. And this was it was like a short speech that you gave, and I found it was really compelling. And there was like a lot of crossover with some of our content recently. But like I previewed maybe 15 minutes ago, it was using that same addition by subtraction approach. Like instead of like endlessly questing for something that you might never find, start getting rid of the things that are only causing you stress, unhappiness, confusion, etc. So can you talk about like what was behind this talk that you gave?
Yeah, I honestly just one morning I just flipped on the mic and decided to just start rambling about it. This started in early 2020, where I really kind of like, I tried something for myself, because right around, I had in March of 2020, I started the month with a 2-week complete fast from all screens. I was off screens 100% for 2 weeks. And I was doing like a health reset and all this other stuff along with it. But so I come back online and I find out, and I didn't know anything about COVID stuff or whatever, because it was right when it kicked off and those 2 weeks became a big deal. I came back online and I find that like the NCAA tournament has been canceled and like everything's getting canceled. And I like couldn't believe it. I was like, are you serious? What? This is crazy. And I had this phenomena happen March, April, May. It just kept escalating where, and again, I don't watch the news. I don't read the news. I don't follow the news, but people are tweeting about it. And like in certain times of the year around elections in particular, or certain events, the people I follow on Twitter are tweeting news stories way more than other times of year. Most of the time, it's not really much. And that's good. I hate knowing what's in the news. I don't like it, but I'm seeing all these news stories, all this information, just like all over the place about COVID and what's happening and blah, 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 and video footage of this and pictures of this and whatever. And I'm like, wow, this picture of the world that's being painted is crazy. Mm-hmm. Then I step outside my door and I go to the grocery store and I interact with my neighbors, and it is nothing. I mean, nothing like it. It's like you're telling me that the sky is green and I'm looking at it and it's blue. That's what it felt. The news was telling me what the world I lived in was like right now, and it literally wasn't like that at all. Same thing happened with when the George Floyd thing happened. It was like, oh my God, racial tensions are insane everywhere. There's protesters. This is crazy. It's like, if you watch that, even my own city in Charleston, they're like, this is happening in Charleston and downtown, blah, blah, blah. Now I'm in the suburbs, but I go to the grocery store. I walk in. If I noticed any difference at all, it was that Black people and white people were smiling and interacting even more than usual. Mm-hmm. And it was like totally zero evidence of anything remotely resembling that. And so I got this point where I'm like, this is a really weird time. I've always felt that the news is inaccurate and puts your focus on a very small number of things in a disproportionate way. But it got to the point where it was like unbelievably so. Like if you sat at home and watched the news, you would literally have a view of the world that was the complete opposite of what's outside your door. Now, I can only speak to my own city and my own experience, but there was nowhere in any news I saw anywhere that said I should expect to experience anything like I did in relation to COVID or in relation to the racial tensions and protests. Nothing at all. So I thought, I'm going to become like a radical empiricist now.
Yeah.
I'm going to be like, if I didn't firsthand experience it, I'm not going to treat it with any truth value. I'm just going to assume it's unknowable to me. I don't know. I'm not going to say it's true or it's not true, right?
Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I've used the phrase "all news is fake news" since you were on the show 6 months ago. I've referenced that so many times, but it's so true. You know, I've been to Florida. I was in Charleston. I was disappointed to learn that you weren't there anymore, but we made the most of it. So all the praxis is gone from Charleston. It's amazing.
Yeah, man. It wasn't expected. It just sort of played out that way. We're like little by little, it was piecing apart. And we're like, man, we have this awesome office here, but we're just not using it that much. Yeah. People are moving and whatever. And so we're back to an all remote team.
And TK is not there.
What's that?
TK is not there anymore.
TK is still in Charleston.
Oh,
But he travels a lot.
Yeah, he's on my list of people to get back on the show too. So that's a shame. Maybe we could have met up. But Charleston was great. And I think the two distinctions or the thing that is different now in the world is like, yeah, people have masks on. And it depends on where you are. Like in Naples, Florida, we walked around without masks. We walked right into a restaurant without masks. We sat down at a bar and talked to a bartender. And in Florida, life seems really normal. And I'm in Butler, Pennsylvania right now. Things seem totally normal here. And when you hear all of these stories about all of these draconian things that are going to be happening, in 2020 or in 2021, you go downtown in this old Rust Belt, you know, this sad and rusty place in a lot of ways aesthetically. But there's no way that's ever happening here. What kind of army would be necessary to make that happen here? I don't know.
No, I'm out in a rural area now.
Forget it. Yeah.
We're out on some land and like, It's incredible. I think that the single predictor of how much bullcrap in terms of, you know, authoritarian overreach in the current climate, an area is willing to put up with, I think population density is probably one of the best predictors. Like,
right.
The less dense the population, the less likely they are to have a bunch of crazy restrictions and bullshit going on.
Yeah.
You just get out in these rural areas and it's like, nope, things are normal here.
Absolutely. So I've seen that in a lot of places. And right now, I went back to New Hampshire last year temporarily, but that was a decision I made in March based on the information that I had at the time and was there most of the year. And then started towards the end of the year, started to travel around again. I'm going to resettle out here. I love it out here. This is such a great place, but I'm looking for that like sweet spot between like urban access and rural, you know, the culture.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yep.
I think if there's a place I can find it, it's here, which is one of the reasons why I've thought about resettling here. But yeah. So how do we get to, you guys are out of Charleston.
So the podcast episode. Mm. So as I was like, you know, I'm trying to tune out the news and everything, but I'm also trying to navigate the world, right? I have a business I'm trying to build. I have a family I'm trying to raise. And so I want to be savvy on what I expect to happen, because this is a very tumultuous and unpredictable time economically, culturally, more so than I can remember in my lifetime, I think. And so in trying to understand like what's going on in the world and what's likely to happen, trying to figure out the truth about anything that's being claimed is like damn near impossible. There's just this flood of information, a lot of bad information, a lot of good information, a lot of contradictory information. And literally you could get sucked in to endlessly searching, or you latch onto something just because you're so tired of searching. You just want to find something that you can say, this is what's true. Cause I don't want to keep being agnostic. It's exhausting.
You want to do sense making.
Exactly. And so you just pick something that, you know, whatever validates your experience or whatever. And you just latch onto it and become an evangelist for it. And I'm like, I don't want any of that. So I'm not even going to try. I'm not even going to try to figure out what's true. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a relentless pursuit of what's not true. And I'm going to try to figure out all the things that I can say, okay, this is bullshit. I can prove that it's bullshit. And then I can eliminate that and say, I know that this isn't true. I don't know what is true, but I know that that isn't true. And you know what's amazing? Once you start doing that,
it's a lot.
The list of things that are like easily discernible as bullshit, when you start looking for bullshit, if you go on a bullshit hunt exclusively, it's incredible. And the number of things that are remaining in the this might be true bucket is actually kind of small.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I think that was like a misinterpretation of what would happen, and maybe a rose-colored glasses prediction about the future that I made 10 years ago. It was like, with this technology, all the truth will come out. Well, maybe that was true, but it was 100x'd by bullshit at least, maybe 1,000x'd by bullshit. And I actually think, and you said something similar to this, it's an exciting problem to have, whether people want to do it or not. And maybe right now, most people don't want to do it. It is a greater test of the human mind, right? It's kind of forcing people to engage with more discomforting, confusing types of things. And that's not really a process most people have ever been invited to do, especially, you know, if somebody's like 25 years old, where would they ever, practice this before? And I was kind of thinking just about maybe the last 25 years ago with information access and information diet and, the noise pollution around that. It's kind of like the process of going to public school, going to college, and then growing up, right? So like you go to public school, you're put on this very specific set of tracks where it doesn't really seem like almost anything that could be explored in the world could be debated. Like you're kind of invited to join the world that is already perfectly functioning and already perfectly settled. And if you behave, you can like stay and participate. And then you go to college and you get these kind of Marxist or socialist professors and they're like, look, kids, everything you've been told your entire life is some bullshit Disney version of history, and I'm here to give you the truth, and the truth is socialism, or whatever, you know, or all the things that they're spewing in higher ed now. But it feels like that kind of intellectual adolescence that I think we're in collectively with information technology right now, where, you know, I remember going to college and getting this, the revisionist history, and there wasn't much like in terms of social justice when I was in college, even though there was a lot of social justice in the culture in the late 90s. People forget that was like a real hot time for a lot of that. But I don't remember too much of it in college, or maybe I just wasn't paying attention to it. But whatever I got in college, I really wanted to pontificate about it. Then, you know, I found other things to pontificate about. And then I like to think I kind of grew up. Right. And I'm done. I hope am I pontificating right now? I hope I'm done. But yeah, I mean, obviously I've developed a more, I like to think a softer conscious approach to trying to share information with people. But man, when I was 21 years old and, you know, coming out of that kind of education, I was such an asshole. And then I became a libertarian at 27 or 28 years old. And I forgive myself and I totally understand. And I'm not, you know, judging my past self. But I didn't take an entirely different set of tactics to, you know, libertarianism either when I started trying to preach about that. So, and I think that ideology invites that in a lot of ways. Like you have a kind of moral and intellectual superiority and go out there with that sword and slay your enemies, you know? But that's the thing is like, some of us grew up in a world where there was none of this. Then we get exposed to all this stuff, but we don't know what to do with it. And then eventually we kind of grow up.
Yeah, I think a big part for me has been learning to be unthreatened. Mm. And that's huge. Like once you are in a space where you're unthreatened, right? So like my views about the uselessness of college in most cases or the, you know, education, whatever, I'm so comfortable in those. I have such a clear understanding of, you know, why I think those things. I'm utterly unthreatened. If somebody comes and says, well, college changed my life, you know, what are you going to say about that? Nothing in me rises up or feels threatened by that at all. Mm-hmm. And I feel no pressure to like win an argument, even if it's public or whatever, in the least. I'll be like, hey man, good for you. I'm glad.
Yeah.
You know, or I might throw in something like, you know, maybe you should go back again and it could change the way you commute. I don't know. But you know, like I don't feel threatened by that. And the more areas where I feel unthreatened, and that's where this approach of like, okay, look, I'm going to take the burden off myself to find what's true. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to say my job is to not fall prey to bullshit. That's it. I'm just going to, if I can avoid falsehood, then I'm moving in the right direction. And so when somebody says, that's bullshit, I'm not threatened by it because all I'm interested in is whether or not I think it is bullshit. I don't need to defend it as true, right? Like if everything's like, and again, this is not a moral relativist argument. I'm not a moral relativist. And I think there are very few things that like, I feel very strongly about that I think are true. Like I think it's wrong to go murder someone, right? I think that's a truth that, and I'm willing to defend that truth, but it's a very small number. It's a very simple number when it comes to claims about the world, you know, like how dangerous is COVID or what will a $15 minimum wage, what will that do? Right. I don't need to have a claim about what's true,
right?
But I need to be able to navigate obvious falsehoods or not so obvious falsehoods. And I think that just, it like releases the pressure. And then you get to become kind of an explorer and an investigator and you get to learn something from everybody.
And you get to signal that into the world. Like how much good would that do? I think the people who want to, you know, manipulate the public mind or manage perceptions, they love having and nothing against Alex Jones, but they love having an Alex Jones around who's just like, look, here's how it is. I've been saying the same thing for 20 years. I've been right about everything. Here's what you have to do. Here's how you have to act. Here's how you have to think. That's far safer because that's just creating a whole bunch of predictable followers who are going to think and feel and do whatever he says. But imagine if there was somebody with a platform that size, with that energy saying, ask questions, modeling curiosity for millions of people, saying, I don't care where you wind up. You could wind up thinking I'm an idiot. Fine. But ask these questions and engage in these exercises of skepticism and curiosity. That would be a dangerous person.
You know, it's funny, you hear the phrase a lot that we're in a post-truth era.
Yeah.
And I know what that means. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, right? Like, I think that, ironically, I think there's truth to that. I think we're in an era where facts don't really matter that much. Mm. It's kind of a magical narrative-driven era where people will jump to a narrative pretty quickly because they're so drowned out in facts that they know are untrue that suddenly facts themselves have just lost weight. But I think rather than post-truth, I think what's in more danger is curiosity.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't want to see go away. Like, I don't want to enter a post-curiosity. So I'll give you an example. Like when all this stuff started, there was all those videos of people like passing out in the streets in China.
Yeah.
You remember those? Mm-hmm. Is anybody asking about those now? Like, hey, that's weird because I haven't seen any other claims or videos or evidence anywhere else in the world that anything like this happens with a supposed COVID infection. Are we not curious about that? Why? What were these videos? Where do they come from? Who are the people? Who is your, like, curiosity? Ask those questions. And I think that's what I don't want to see lost. A big entering a post-curiosity era, that's concerning to me, where whatever the newest narrative is, it's literally, I always thought 1984 was just a big giant allegory, big metaphor in an exaggerated way. It's not even exaggerated. It's literally like, oh, we're at war with Eurasia. We've always been at war with Eurasia. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever believed anything different, right? Like rewriting the past and not even saying, wait a minute, I thought this was what we were worried about 2 minutes ago. That ability to flip attention from one claim or one idea or one, you know, observation to another, and not just take our attention away from the first one, but to proceed as if it never happened and it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. That's dangerous to me. And that's where looking for bullshit instead of trying to, because then you don't have to say, no, this one was true, not this one. You just get to say, wait a minute, then what are we saying about this thing that we used to say in the past, right? Can someone explain that? Do you have an answer for me? You know,
this is a really worthwhile thing to try and model to not doing it from an ideological perspective. Now, obviously, you're going to have the problem where if you make somebody uncomfortable, they're going to have their label maker out going, what do I put on you so I can basically forget what you're saying, throw you away? And with, you know, conspiracy theorist, I mean, racist, insurrectionist, these are all useful terms today. But if there was a way to like present in a non-threatening way, like I'm just asking questions. Now, I've done this. I've done some. All right. So this summer, I was talking to this woman and she thought it was just a perfectly okay thing to say. Like it was a small talk and COVID came up as it does in small talk these days. And this woman just suddenly feels like it's okay to say, not knowing anything about me, what I think of the world, who I vote for, if I vote at all. She goes, wow, maybe things would be better if we didn't have a president telling people to drink bleach. Like this was a non-controversial statement. So I go, huh. I said, I'm not very political, but I don't believe that. Did he really say that? How did he say that? And use those critical thinking questions like the five W's. But how did he say it? Was he sarcastic? Where did he say it? When did he say that? And just by asking questions, questions are now attacks. The woman said to me, are you up to something? Do you have something you want to say that you're not saying? So I got, by being inquisitive, I became a person of suspicion in this case. But I still think there's a way to do it. I still think there's a way to just say, hey, look, and maybe give them some examples they agree with first, like this thing you hate is bullshit, this thing you hate is bullshit, but so are these things that you like. And I'm just using this, I'm applying the same standards of evaluation and coming to the same conclusion.
So I think the way to do it, and I know you hate memes. I think we talked about
No, I don't anymore. And I just wanted to know, like, is it newspeak? But I just had a conversation. The Honest Teacher, has he ever, do you know who The Honest Teacher is? He worked in the public school system. I just call him Jay. He's an anonymous person, even though there's theories about who he is. But he's got a pretty good page on Facebook where he just does memes on the subject of schooling versus education. So he's been a really good ally. And he was just on my show a couple episodes ago and we talked about this. And, you know, I was just kind of curious what different people's thoughts were about them, but memes are so enjoyable. And okay, I'm screenshotting them all the time. When we were driving down to South Carolina and I had no phone service, but I was compelled to be on my phone for some reason, I'm going through all the screenshots that I've taken in my gallery and it's all memes. It's all just screenshots of memes that I never posted.
So that's where I think, like, rather than trying to fight the zeitgeist of the age that we're in, you roll with it. You ride it like a wave. So we're in an age of magic and narrative and playfulness and humor, by the way. So like, this is why I think a great example is the Babylon Bee.
Yeah,
they're killing it. Yeah. They're hilarious right now. And that's really a total topic for a different day. But isn't it funny how when you and I were growing up in kind of Gen X generation, I never would have believed you if you would told me there will come a day when the funny people are conservatives.
No.
And the unfunny people are, right? All the cool people, the comedians, the actors, whatever, they're all liberals. And conservatives were like boring, fuddy-duddy, like, now kids, don't do drugs. Because they were always preaching at you, don't do drugs. Today, liberals are always preaching at you. You can't just watch Saturday Night Live without somebody trying to preach to you. And preaching is just not as funny as regular comedy. And somehow the conservatives are funnier now, which is funny. Like, I'm not a conservative or a liberal, but just an observation. But
one thing on that, because this is this is really a hobby horse for me. Bill Maher. Bill Maher is somebody who I think he looked in the mirror one day, maybe a couple years ago, and he said, every episode of my show, I'm going to get 1% more based until they cancel me. Like, he made this agreement with himself. And I think one of the reasons why he did it is he understood what comedy actually is. You're not funny because you're called a comedian or because you have a late night show that people have traditionally associated with comedy, because Johnny Carson hosted it 40 years ago, right? That doesn't guarantee anything. But Bill Maher is like, no, comedy has risk, right? And the safest shit to say right now is all of this woke stuff, right? The safest thing to say right now is Trump is the devil, all of these things. And it's not funny. Stephen Colbert's show, which I think was a replacement for Letterman, is North Korean state television at this point. You could watch it for a day and not laugh once. There's not even anything that approaches, you know, being worthy of a laugh in 2021.
Which is crazy, because, you know, as a talent, he is capable of being hilarious.
Because he was, when he understood.
The old Colbert Report was hilarious.
Because he knew that irreverence was important to be funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So here's where you roll with the age that we're in, an age of magic and superstition and playfulness, where, you know, a Fortune 500 CEO is tweeting about Dogecoin, right? Like, and this, this is the world, right? The GameStop thing is like a bunch of goofy Redditors meme their way into a giant scandal on the political, you know, whatever.
Right.
You roll with that. And so when you're facing those encounters, rather than simply saying, asking the question in a factual way, what are those videos from China mean? We need to investigate this, right? Or, well, what did the president really say about bleach? You turn it into a meme, a joke, a story, something that you come up with a meme with, you know, people fainting in China, and you make some sort of joke, and it has this powerful effect of reminding people, hey, remember that this used to be a thing that people were worried about, and kind of putting it in context of the absurdity of how that was the storyline, then it got forgotten, yeah. And now nobody's, and you do it in a playful way, and like, he who memes the best right now wins the power. I mean, I think that's like culturally, politically, whatever. And I'm not interested in political power, but I think you got to roll with that. And when people try to engage you on the factual level, when I see people engaging on the factual level, I'm almost like, I feel like that scene in The Matrix where they're like, oh, our men are bringing her down right now. And the guy says, no, your men are already dead. Your men are already. when I see somebody saying, you know, we need to have more lockdowns and blah, blah, and somebody responding, well, have you seen the comparative stats between Florida and blah, blah, blah? I'm like, your men are already dead.
Right.
You're not going to win. We're not in a fact-based age. You got to meme that shit, or you got to tell a better story, or you got to be more, you know, it's narrative and it's magic and it's myth, you know?
Right. Yeah. So, first of all, there used to be a pretty common phrase in our language that has entirely disappeared. It was two words, and I'm throwing up air quotes, too soon, where something happens and somebody makes an off-color joke and somebody goes, oh, too soon. Today, and I really think this is a phenomenon that's emerged in the last 5 years, whatever it is, it's like, this is funny by 5 o'clock, right?
Yep.
And, you know, the other thing too, just on like post-truth, and I've said this a few times on my show recently, you and I have both identified as libertarians, had friends who are libertarian, been in that world, right? And one thing that I always thought had a pretty, I don't know, unattractive aesthetic was the libertarian victory lap, where something bad would happen in the world and a bunch of people, you know, would take to social media with their pointers and be like, we told you, and, you know, just kind of do that presentation that doesn't really win hearts and minds. But it was the MO of this philosophy for a long time that we were working with this assumption that when X happens, people will realize that they were wrong about Y when X happens. That's over. That's been over for a while. And I think that you're making some really good points and really driving that home about why people need to accept that.
You know, it's funny that the libertarian victory lap. So let's play around with this for a minute.
Sure.
And see how the difference between doing that in a assuming that facts matter versus assuming that narrative right. is all that matters.
Right.
So like, let's say, I don't know, you know, whatever, the market crashes all of a sudden. And because of all this inflation, asset prices are skyrocketing, blah, blah, blah. And it's in a way that a libertarian would say, it's undeniable now that my claims about money printing are now, you know, have come to pass. Now imagine somebody tweeting out, here's a picture of a tweet where I said 2 years ago that this money, the M1 supply is too high and this was going to lead to a crash. I hate to say I told you so, but libertarians were right. Mm-hmm. Okay, now imagine that. Mm-hmm. Think of the impact that might have. Now imagine somebody tweeting that meme where it's like the hand-drawn, like, what's that guy, Wojak or whatever, yeah, the really yeah. plain, and he's standing in the corner at like a party. And then there's like a guy and a girl over to the other side, more of like a Chad type of a guy and a girl. And then like, it has something written over his face, right? And in this case, you would have that, and it would have, you know, normie guy, you know, shocked and disappointed, you know, girl who just lost her job. And then over here, it says like, he's thinking to himself, how do I tell them that I predicted this? And it says like libertarian, right? It's poking fun of yourself as being always the outcast, the idiot, the loser, but it's also revealing this is funny because it's true. Libertarians were saying this mm-hmm. and they were right about it. And this is, and it has this easy way of bringing you into the narrative. And you can say, even if you're not a libertarian, okay, that is funny, right? Like even if you disagree with Peter Schiff, that picture of Peter Schiff standing in the corner, how do I tell them I've been saying buy gold for 10 years? It's funny. Yeah. And it like weaves a narrative that you can't defeat. No one could defeat that by responding and saying, yeah, but your predictions as libertarians were always incorrect. That person looks like an idiot because they're responding to a meme with a fact, right? Yeah. And they're losing. They're losing the narrative war.
Right. So my audience will hear this Tuesday, the 23rd. And on the 25th, they're going to hear this show, or maybe the 21st, or maybe Monday. My audience is going to hear this on Monday. And then later that week, they'll hear this show that I recorded this morning about StoryBrand and the power of story. That's what we're talking about. And I've heard more and more libertarian people say, like Dave Smith talks about this. Pete Kanonas talks about this. We need better narratives. Right? Where it always is that attempt to do the victory lap and somebody's just like, shut up, nerd. Nobody even knows what you're talking about. You know? So you're absolutely right. I think as things go forward, anybody who is promoting more liberty in any theater of life, right, needs to remember that the I told you so argument, if you even want to call that, is a big loser. Right. Because somebody could lay out the greatest argument about why the stock market crashes, and somebody else could say it was Russian bots. And people go, I like that. It's more like a James Bond movie.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Have you ever talked to Vin Armani?
I haven't, but we have a mutual friend and I've been really interested in connecting with him. He's in Saipan.
Okay. Because a lot of his, he kind of gave really good language and some really good insight into a lot of this stuff. For me, he helped me like things that I was observing, but I wasn't quite sure what I was observing. He really helped put him into a nice frame for me. And he has this phrase, he calls it the dim age, but it's basically this idea that I've been talking about that like, look, we're in an age where everything's magical now, right? Everything's right. superstitious and whatever. And yeah, he'd be an interesting guy to chat with about this, about, you know, navigating the dim age or the post, you know, the post-truth age or whatever you want to call it. Because I've gotten a lot of benefit to listen to him talk about it.
Awesome. Well, hey, I wanted your thoughts on a quote that is actually from that guy that I mentioned to you, Eric Hofer, at the beginning of the show. And I think it kind of lines up with both the career approach and the truth-seeking approach. Eric Hofer said, I don't think it was in The True Believer, but it might have been. He said, the search for happiness is one of the chief sources of unhappiness. Thoughts?
I think that's absolutely right. And that's very much in line with, you know, the main theme behind don't do stuff you hate. Mm. Once you, even that word, happiness, go find happiness. Mm. It induces stress in most people
because then you're like pressure. Yeah.
Right. That's a big ask. What is it? And the self-knowledge and self-honesty required to even deal with that is something that's a process. You can't just know right away, right? Like the things you think are going to make you happy that don't, or things that you wish you were the kind of person that was, you know, happy with no money, but really you're not that kind of person. You got to be honest about that, right? This is a big process and it's a big painful one. And we tend to fall into a lot of, speaking of bullshit, that like the best bullshitter you'll ever encounter is yourself, right? And
yes.
we fall into a lot of narrative making and justificatory stuff. If it's like, go find happiness, that's so monumental that we make excuses. Well, it really does make me happy to dispel it. And you get in this big web. So I think that is a really, really big challenge that like, again, maybe it worked for some people, but for me, it doesn't. And that's exactly why I'm like, okay, let me just be brutally honest about what's not making me happy. And not do that. And that can be hard too, right? Because like I've had instances where I had a job that I loved, that I was pretty good at, mm-hmm. that on paper other people would have seen as something that was enviable. And they would have said, wow, that's a great job. And I discovered that I hated it, that it started to make me dead inside little by little. Yes. I didn't hate it at first, but over time, and I'm like, but that's who I am. That's my identity. Everybody, all these reasons why I shouldn't hate it. But the fact of the matter was I did hate it. And if I would have had to say, well, I have to go do what I love, I never would have left because I didn't know what I loved. I would have just kept tolerating that because I'm like, well, I can't think of what I love. So I just have to keep. But when I said, I can't do stuff I hate, I can't, it's going to kill me. It forced me to confront that and to go leave that job and do something that I didn't think I would hate and find out if, you know, later on, you're going to have to deal with your own bullshit one way or the other. I think it's much easier if you can strip it down and say, can I be honest about when I hate something and not do it anymore versus can I find out what I love? There's too many layers of bullshit to get through there.
Yeah. And I think that the more young people can be introduced to this idea, the better. It was instinctive for me in the education profession where I just knew what I couldn't do anymore. And I'm not going back and reinventing myself as a moral actor. I was a lazy 23, 24, 25 year old person who said, this is a good excuse for why this sucks and I shouldn't do anymore. Standing in a closet filled with drugs going, wow, I can't believe part of my job is to give speed to 11 year olds. Right? Like, geez, I really wish I had a job where I didn't have to give drugs to 11-year-olds. Even without all the politics or the awareness that I have today, something felt really shitty about giving a kid a medication two or three times a day and watching him go, if it wasn't speed, it was something that just made him go from 100 pounds to 200 pounds in 6 months. It doesn't feel good to watch kids like lose themselves and become lethargic and not want to do it. And you can see this transformation in a very narrow period of time. It felt like shit. So like knowing that that's something that has to go and not finding some kind of sophisticated justification, which a lot of smart people can do. And especially if they're, you know, more entrenched in something like that, it gets easier and easier to do. It's pretty hard to have a conversation about public school with somebody who's been there for 30 years and probably knows deep down somewhere they've done a lot of damage or they've been a willing participant in a system that's done a lot of damage. So I was lucky.
Oh my gosh.
I was just lucky, not as, morally superior to anybody else who was doing that job. I had no more information than the average 23 or 24-year-old in that building or in that environment. And I just went, oh, you know, I'm lazy. I don't want to – this. That's a good reason to not do this. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what else I'll do. I don't know what will make me happy, but it's not this. And eventually that got me to doing this, right?
Yep.
It wasn't a straight line.
No, absolutely. I had a somewhat similar experience when I worked in the political realm. Yeah. I worked in the state legislature and it was like the people I would see who had been there for 20 or 30 years working as staffers for these various state reps, the stories they would tell themselves and tell others about themselves were just sad. And I was new enough to see that, but I was also like, put the pieces together enough to realize, but that will become me. That will become me. I will tell those same stories and young kids will look at me and think that I'm sad for coming up with this BS story for why I'm still working here. You know, and even people, I mean, I remember one guy, like he worked for like one of the most statist, you know, state senators that there was. And at the time they were arguing for some massive tax increase and blah, blah, blah. I walk into his office and I see Atlas Shrugged and I say, whose book is that? He said, oh, it's mine. I go, yeah. He goes, yeah, I love Rand. I'm a libertarian. And he said it with like, no, he had completely disconnected his ideology from what he did every day to just as a survival mechanism as like to such an extent that he wasn't even aware of the fact that that might be hard to reconcile for me to see that he's advocating for a massive tax increase while being a libertarian Rand fan, right? And I remember seeing that and being like, oh my gosh, I see how this happens, right? I see what happens here. I got to get out. Nobody's strong enough to not become something they don't want to be if they stay in the environment for
that long. Yeah, that's scary. You know? I mean, that is pretty scary, right? Because you see this stuff and you go, oh, this, it just must be this incredible information deficit that these people, or they've just, you know, that even sounds judgmental. It's just like, I forgive this person for, you know, not having the good fortune of being exposed to all of these things that would have, you know, shaped a more compassionate or rational worldview. But it's like, no, I got that.
That's what's so creepy about DC. I lived in DC for 2 years and I worked for a libertarian nonprofit, not for the, government bureaucracy. But what's so scary about it is when you know the kind of things that government does, this constant overreach and all of the rhetoric coming out about, social planning and welfareism and all this stuff, you imagine the beast, all the people that operate it in behind the scenes, being these ideological socialists that want to take over, like you would see an AOC tweeting or whatever.
Yeah.
What's even more terrifying is they're utterly non-ideological. All the people that work there and run the bureaucracies, almost all of them are just, they don't care.
Operators.
They're just drones. They're just, they don't care. They just want to get their pension. They'll do whatever. And that's even more terrifying. It's way more terrifying to face someone who in the metro has no life in their eyes, but they go in every day and push papers around that ruin people's lives without any thought or any connection to any broader philosophy. That is a much more terrifying beast to contend with than someone who has some rabid belief in the virtues of, socialism or whatever.
It's much more, because those are the operators. Those are the people who make that happen. So if somebody who does have those beliefs is able to access the right levers, those people follow along in that mechanical process exactly how they're supposed to do as far as it guarantees their continued comforts. So yeah, you're right. Want to end on that high note, Isaac?
Well, look, here's the good news.
Yeah.
You don't have to become that. You don't have to become someone who's detached from the things that mean a lot to you or your values or having just interestingness in your life. You don't have to become that. And you don't have to know how to not be that in order to not be that, right? You don't have to know, what do I need to do to be fully engaged and to be true to myself, whatever. You just have to be careful not to fall into bullshit. Yeah. Don't do stuff you hate. Don't believe in lies. Just take that sword to eliminate bad stuff, bad information, bad choices, bad careers, bad whatever. And don't worry about finding out what's right. Let that emerge as you eliminate the things that are, you know, to be bad. And then you'll have all kinds of delightful surprises along the way and you'll be open. You won't be beholden to any one particular path or outcome, or fact that needs to be true. You'll end up with all kinds of amazing discoveries and a path that you didn't expect, but that you love. So there's the positive note.
Excellent. If my audience wants to hear more of you, you have at least one active podcast right now, probably more. And where can they find you online? And it's crash.co. That's linked all over my website. People know it well. But if people are interested in you personally, where can they check in with you?
Yeah, and I got to say, by the way, I know we've definitely had some Crash users who came from School Sucks community. So, IsaacMorehouse.com is the best place. I'm on Twitter as well, at Isaac Morehouse. But, I blog occasionally. I podcast sometimes. I've got, all kinds of stuff going. So that's probably the best one stop.
Well, these are always such great conversations. Thank you for taking the time to do it. And I'm sure I'm going to be reaching out to you in a few more months to do it again.
Sounds good, man. My man.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to cut it there. It takes two to make a thing go right. Come on. It takes two to make it out of sight. Remember, we're working hard at School Sucks Project to make sure we are respectful of your precious media consumption time, and in that time, provide you the best information diet we can. With shows like this, you can support these efforts by going to patreon.com/schoolsucks or schoolsucksproject.locals.com. This week, there'll be new episodes of the University Weekly Discussion Group and The Discomfort Zone. Thank you to everybody who helps us out and takes the time to listen to our additional productions.